Thanks for coming to this. How many of you are like me and this is your first South by Southwest? Wow, good grief. It's big. I did not know South by Southwest was this big, so I'm glad the room is dark because I'm going to get less nervous now that I can't see you all. So what I'm going to try to do here, this is going to be pretty quick and pretty basic. And I'm going to walk through a little bit about me and how I became a designer, and then I'm going to go over some really basic concepts and principles for your design process that can hopefully help you be a bang-up, awesome content management system web designer. So let's get started. My name is Jared Ponchat. I'm a web designer. I'm jponch on Twitter and Dribbble. If you're, after this talk, feeling like this was way too basic and you want more, or you think I was way wrong and you want to tell me about it, let me know. Hit me up on Twitter. I work for a company called Lullabot. I'm the creative director. We're an interactive agency, and we're most known for having a lot of the world's top Drupal experts. How many people know anything about Drupal in this room? A little bit. How many people wish you didn't know anything about Drupal? Okay. Anyways, I work with a lot of really smart people who know a lot about Drupal. And I'll get a little bit more to that. Well, Lullabot's, but we're an interactive agency. We work on really fun projects. We do the Grammys. I think this is the third year in a row we've done Grammy.com. It's a really fun thing to try to keep that site online during the Grammys show. MarthaStewart.com, WWE.com, which incidentally I think is like one of the highest trafficked media streaming websites on the internet. And let's see. My clicker's not working. MIT, we recently worked on a really cool project for MIT that we're still working on. MIT's doing a partnership with Khan Academy. Are you familiar? Anybody have used Khan Academy? Sal Khan is actually going to be on 60 Minutes tomorrow, I think, talking a little bit about this project. We just recently designed and launched this site. It's really cool. It actually does video experiments. MIT students doing video experiments for K-12 students. Really cool. So I thought it'd be interesting to give you a little biographical background to start off this narrative and how I became a designer. So how many out there, as a young child, you said, when I grow up, I want to be a web designer? I don't see a single hand. I expected there to be someone. My assumption is that if you were born after 1990, that may be something that you could say. Anyway, I grew up, I think my first like elementary school like career day, I was like 9 and I dressed in a lab coat and I put food coloring into test tubes and I wanted to somehow be a scientist or something. I didn't think about being a designer until much later, but there were really early signs at an early age that I look back on that are interesting to me. Like, for one thing, I would spend hours in my room with large sheets of paper. My mom was an elementary school teacher. I would have her bring them home, and I would draw complex highway systems. So some little boys are into cars. I was like into how you move the cars through things. I would spend hours on this. I would also do schematic drawings to scale of my bedroom and every element in it. And probably every 1 to 2 months, I would actually try to rearrange based on those and do a new schematic. So I was a really cool kid and had lots and lots of friends. So this was just to show that I was a cool kid. I was really into Ruse tennis shoes. This has absolutely no relevance to this talk, but they were amazing. I don't know if anybody remembers them. And it makes me think that there's like other things that we use in our paraphernalia that we should add pockets to. It's really cool. So this is my son, Huxley, at 4 years old. He plays with cars all the time, and this is how he plays with cars. This is much like how I played with cars when I was little. Notice like the beautiful alignments he creates. He actually has a proportional grid system going on. This is for real, though. He's very meticulous about it. His OCD like passed through my genes into him very much so. So eventually I grew up, and I'm sorry. I'm trying to move fast so you don't get too like, oh, I didn't come to hear about Jared Ponchat's childhood and stuff. I did go to design school eventually. This was mostly a product of, like, I think my junior, senior year, sat down with a guidance counselor, told her how I wanted to be a writer. She told me I could never make a living as a writer. I should cancel this scholarship I had for a lit major, and I should do something else. So I chose art school. And I went to design school. I went to a school called Ringling College of Art and Design. Anybody heard of it before? It's a really small school. They're most known for the fact that, like, I think in the last decade, they've probably had 9 or 10 alumni win Academy Awards. Several of the founders of Pixar are Ringling grads. Their design and their computer animation departments are amazing. Really cool place. If you ever are down in Sarasota, Florida, coastal Florida, check it out. Like, go visit the galleries and stuff. So what did I learn in design school? There are three things that I learned. I hopefully learned more than three things, but I'm going to talk about three right now. I learned to think creatively. Design school really helped me understand both a process for and how to begin working through creative problem solving. More than anything, I think design school taught me how to critique. If any of you are designers, or especially if you're a friend of a designer, you know that designers can be the biggest critics in the world. And that's because we go through 4 years of college where most of the time you're in there having a professor teach you how to critique something. And it taught me to create systems. Now, this sounds like it's perfect for setting me up for being a content management system designer. The systems that we developed in design school were more about creating what one of my professors, he loved to talk about university, which the word university comes from the idea of unity within diversity. And design systems need to have unity within diversity. That's how brands are created. So this is a really poor photo of a project I had when I was in college. We were each assigned a word. These words were generated from a process where all the students had to provide words that were all put in a hat. We all pulled out 5 words, and we had to take 2 of those 5 and combine them to make a word. I had zonk and rocket, and I chose zonk it. And from that, we had to develop a brand and develop an actual product line and do packaging for it. And it was all in a very short time frame kind of a thing. So it's like quickly what you can make in the next week kind of a thing. So I love story, and what I did with this was I created a story of this guy that I thought Zonkit sounded like this odd, quirky German name. If your last name is Zonkit and it's not German, I apologize. So I created this Helmut Zonkit, Dr. Helmut Zonkit, and the story is while studying for a degree in drama at Universität Bremen in Germany, a young Helmut Zonkit discovered a peculiar problem. Making money to pay for his schooling through his wildly entertaining party acts, Helmut was known for a rather messy trick involving a trumpet that sprayed chocolate sauce. The trick went over with mixed reviews, due in large part to the difficulty involved in cleaning the chocolate off of the cone-shaped party hats. An active spelunker himself, Zonkit knew all too well this difficulty. After several attempts at cave restoring proved difficult due to the challenges involved in cleaning stalactites. During his third trimester, Helmut decided to become a chemistry major and begin his quest for the perfect conical cleaning method. His quest proved successful, and now Zonkit is revered as one of the leading authorities on cone cleaning, as well as one of the most interesting innovators of the past century. Zonkit Etc. Unlimited is the world's leading supplier of cleaning products for cone-shaped objects. Zonkit has also innovated in other fields and is fondly known by some as the father of metric time. He is also known as the only living scientist to boast a self-proclaimed element, Zonkitium. So I created this whole line of products, basically, which was mostly cone cleaning products that had fantastic claims and used all kinds of Masonic symbols that were related to the cone shape. And it was a lot of fun. I'm showing it to give you the idea of sort of what design school can do, like the kinds of things you're focused on, and then how you can come out of that and you start working and you end up getting into maybe web design and then you begin working with systems. It's like, this is a whole new world. The other thing is design feels really fun and playful when you're talking about projects like that, but it's deadly important. Like, design can be the difference between going east and west. It can be the difference between ending up in the men's room when you're supposed to be in the ladies' room. There's all kinds of things that design really, I mean, look at medical supplies, it's like really actually critically important. And so let's talk a little bit about why. Design, Viktor Papanek, I love the way he puts it. He says, design is the conscious effort to impose a meaningful order. And I think that this is kind of the key theme that I want to surround when we're talking about a few things for designing for content management systems. So the reality of designing for content management systems is that CMSs inherently create ways of imposing meaningful order. This is the type of problem solving that I was drawn to as a child, and it's what these things just naturally do. They sometimes do it in ways that really frustrate us, but we need to understand this. So there's lots of content management systems out there, blogging engines that have become more content management systems. How many of you have worked with Expression Engine? Oh, really? I thought there'd be more at a South by Southwest. Shows you that I've never been to South by Southwest. WordPress? People work with WordPress? Yeah. Movable Type? Anybody done that? Joomla? Yeah. How many have like actually designed or built a Drupal site? Wow, this is a pretty... I'm actually surprised. WordPress actually had a pretty lot of hands there, but actually overall that was pretty even. So some web designers that I know like that seem to be completely unaware of Drupal wonder how is it that I became attracted to Drupal. And it's an interesting thing. A lot of designers, I found the reasons they're not attractive is they view Drupal as this really unwieldy, powerful thing that can't fit in their pocket, like that's out of control. That you install it. Like when I first came to Drupal, like you would go to the modules page and it looked something like this, where you had all these things that you could turn on, and then you turn them all on and you still didn't really have much of a site, and what you had, you didn't know how to change it and you didn't like it. The irony is that the other complaint often is that Drupal out of the box is very little. It makes very few assumptions about the type of site you're going to build, the type of content that you're working with, about any of that. It creates a scenario where you can begin to ask those questions. And that's actually what I loved about Drupal and what I still like about Drupal for all its flaws. Another reason designers can be averse to Drupal is just because they're familiar with lots of wonderfully beautiful Drupal sites like these. They're just, you know, the list goes on. Now, there actually are a number of really beautiful Drupal sites, and I encourage you to try to find them because these are not all there is. Now let's get into some of the meat of this. What drew me to Drupal really was how it thinks and how it, by design, creates an opportunity for you to structure your content and determine contextual responses. This is basically my sort of simple, basic key to designing for content management systems, and this is not tied to Drupal necessarily. I'm going to use some terminology and explain a little bit about how Drupal approaches this, but this is an approach that no matter what content management system you're working with is a good approach for how you should start your design process and the types of questions you should be asking in that design process. So the three things that I want to kind of talk about are contexts, user types, and content types. So I know I said that in that order, and content types was last, but I'm actually going to start with that because really it's the meat and potatoes of it. It starts from that and works outward. So content types are exactly what they sound like. They are types of content. So some examples of types of content might be if you're a news organization and you have lots of publishing happening on your website, you might have article content types. If you're Lullabot, you might have articles because you have a blog, but you also do a podcast, so you might have a podcast content type. If you're Martha Stewart, you might have a recipe content type. If you're a radio show, you might have an episode content type. And then those content types are made up of fields, chunks of information or data that create this content. So the recipe example, you might have a title field, a byline field, a summary, a list of ingredients, a list of wine pairings, categories of cuisine types, and ways to taxonomize it, those kinds of things. The key with the idea of content types and fields and starting there in your design process by uncovering what those are and how they're structured and what the relationships are is it allows you to begin to model content as opposed to just coming in and beginning to try to format and style it. And that's one of the real keys in designing for content management systems is to start by modeling content. And formatting and styling is at the very, very end. So A List Apart recently published this great article by Sarah something. I don't know how to say her last name, and her Twitter thing, her description said, like, my name eats character limits for breakfast or something like that and didn't tell me how to pronounce it. Watcher, Bocher, something. But it's a fantastic article. You should read it. It's called Future Ready Content. She makes the case for this type of an approach to design as well as to content strategy. Her case is for doing this so that your content is future ready. Basically, it's ready to one day live in lots of different places on varying devices because you've structured it appropriately and different bits of it are available to use that target the use case and the user that you're targeting in any given device and scenario. So Karen McGrain, I recently went to an event apart Atlanta. She's doing this great talk about structured content. And she talks about how the publishing industry actually was really sort of leading the way in structured content for years, well before web designers really had to tackle this. A newspaper is a good way to think about this, where they have, you can look it up on Wikipedia, like a news styling, and there's like common news styles that are basically the way they structure content, where you have a head and a deck and a lead and maybe a nut graph. And these are used for the same way that in a content management system, structured content lets you choose which chunks are appropriate for which user type in which context. A newspaper might say, only show the headline and the deck for something to tease it on the front page of the newspaper and draw you in, and when you're actually reading the full article, some of those chunks aren't even there or visible. Another just really valuable thing to remember in uncovering content types in their chunks or fields in your design process is it's an opportunity to create goals. A lot of us are accustomed to setting organizational or creative goals for a site during the early stages of a design process. You might do discovery with a client and try to uncover what the business goals are. Content types are a way to think through a content management system powered site where you don't actually know what all their content is. You begin to break down what these types are, what the chunks are, and begin to actually have goals for each type of content, as opposed to this sort of frustration of nebulous, not yet to be written content. So user types. This also is exactly what it sounds like. It's types of users. Important questions to ask when you're trying to uncover the user types in the early phases of your design process is what are they using it for? And you need to ask this contextually. What is this user type using this for in this context? And are they anonymous or authenticated? And what that means, Hulu, for example, has anonymous users. These are just anybody who comes to Hulu can watch all the stuff that's available to anonymous users. Once you're authenticated with the site, meaning you've logged in, it probably means you're a subscriber, but there might be more than one authenticated role. Authenticated users have permissions that anonymous users don't have and can access different types of content. But with Hulu, if you're authenticated as a subscriber to Hulu Plus, you can access a whole library of content that's not available to the anonymous users. It's a pretty simple concept. It's an important thing to ask very early on in your design process when you're working with designing for content management systems, is what are the user types? What are they trying to do in what contexts? Another thing to remember is that content creators are users too. In some sites, you may have more than one authenticated user type. Like a publishing heavy site could easily have authors, editors, administrators, moderators, authors writing content, editors editing and working back and forth with authors, whole workflows surrounding that, administrators managing all these users, and moderators handling the comments, moderating the comments, and all these kinds of things. Jeff Eaton, one of my coworkers, wrote a fantastic article last spring called "Baby Got Backend," and it's great. You should Google it. What the article is about is a lot of times designers focus so much on this anonymous traffic. Websites are designed around what it looks like to the person who just arrives there and what happens for that user. A lot of times, content creators are sort of second banana and an afterthought in design processes. It's really important to think like a content creator early and often when you're designing for content management systems. It gives you a better understanding of the content structure when you begin to ask questions like, is this going to be frustrating for people when they're creating it because it's too laborious, because we've separated this out into too many discrete chunks? Or have we created blobs here where they're given too much power and, you know, with great power comes great responsibility, and these content creators are not going to use that well? you begin to think about these things, not only will it improve the actual content creation workflow, but it may actually change the chunks that you're left with to work with in your front-end design. You'll just produce better designs as well. And one of the big things about this is actually that you'll increase the likelihood of a successful project and a happy client. A lot of people don't think about the fact that a lot of times the real stakeholders in a project have day-to-day contact with the content creators of a website. And they don't have day-to-day contact with the average visitor who hits the homepage. And that content creator day-to-day experiencing pain over and over and over again makes this website feel more and more and more unsuccessful, even if it's beautifully designed. It's a very important thing that's sort of key in content management system design. Don't forget the content creators. So contexts. A context provides conditions and reactions based upon a defined criteria. So how many are familiar with the basic programming concept of if, then, else? Yeah. Basically, it's what it sounds like. If this is true, if X is true, sort of like an algebra, or it's like a Boolean, if this is true, then do that. If the user is this type of user, then show them this. Contexts work like this. Now, context is a term in Drupal, if you're a Drupal person, that has been sort of used for a number of different things, and so it's it has... Like, there's a nomenclature creep happening, which creates some confusion. I'm using it in a broad sense of just how to approach design. I don't care if you're working with WordPress or any kind of system for managing dynamic content. Uncovering what the key contexts are, where the relationships happen that create the conditions for the reactions early on is an important thing. Let's see. In context, okay, so context, a lot of conditions will be something like content types. Like, if you're looking at this type of content, then also display this in the sidebar. Or user type context, like I just described. Or section, structural contexts. If you're in this section of the page, like, the site will know it because you're looking at this type of content. If you're in this section, as long as you're in this section, always be displaying these types of things. Uncovering those things, listing them out, gives you something to work with in your design process so you can actually have something even if the content doesn't live yet. So recapping, contexts provide conditions and reactions to help organize and place things throughout our site. User types are anonymous or authenticated, and they're used to set permissions or provide conditions for contexts. And content types are the meat and potatoes of our website, and they help model our content and provide meaningful order. So a couple of things. Why should we think this way? Why should we approach web design with these things early on in our process? There's a few things. One is just even if you think this is wrong, if your natural bent is to say, this type of a process becomes way too granularly focused and you're going to miss the big picture or something, whatever it is, this is how content management systems think. And so if you're saying that that's your problem, you need to understand the problem so you can start figuring out how you're going to solve it in this project. The other thing is it just simplifies complexity. Designing for content management systems, a lot of times, it depends on the scale of the projects, but there's a lot of projects where you think the scale is not that big, and then you begin to do this work, and you uncover that you have 12 different types of content, and a number of relationships that are happening, and there's a lot of ways that you could slice this pie to present it to the users. So doing this kind of a process, asking these questions, nailing these things down, begins to sort of take away some of that complexity and gives you a way to focus, gives you a way to work in teams so you can begin to divide these things up. You can say, this person tackle this content type even. And then a big thing is just we can't design for each piece of content on a dynamic site. Our site may begin with 50 pieces of content on it and have hundreds or even thousands a couple months later. We just cannot be producing custom wireframes, mocks, markup, and CSS for every piece of content that lives on a site that's powered this way. So we need to have smart and sensible ways of identifying the ways this content should be formatted. And the way to do that is these types. This approach is also very helpful if you're planning for responsive design. The interesting thing is, like, responsive design has come to mean this very, very, like, sort of simple technical approach to solving how websites basically respond to just one condition. When I was talking about sort of conditions and reactions, like, the only condition is the size of the browser, pretty much, when people are referring to that. Content management systems for years have been doing responsive design by responding to all kinds of conditions. Front-end developers were just forgetting there was not a great need for it for years. There weren't the devices with the different sizes. But this will begin to help you think in a way that actually translates really well to responsive design. Structured content makes responsive design easier. I like to think it creates the stairs that can be progressively enhanced into the escalator, like Mitch Hedberg talks about. He says, an escalator can never break. It can only become stairs. You should never see an escalator temporarily out of order sign, just escalator temporarily stairs. Sorry for the convenience. I don't know if you've ever listened to Mitch Hedberg, but he's fantastic. But yeah, so having structured content sort of creates those stairs, which can be progressively enhanced, which is really actually a freeing thing. So let's get even more practical here. I'm going to walk you through a real client project that I'm actually working on right now. I just started it recently, and just demonstrate a couple of these concepts by looking at an actual wireframe. This project is for a popular radio show, and the key type of content for this project is an episode of the show. Users come to the site for that, to try to drill down and find this thing that they heard talked about, that sort of thing. Interestingly, as I researched other radio show websites and how they approach this, it's fascinating, like, how much disparity. There's not a lot of user patterns around this, and it's really poorly done almost across the board. There wasn't a lot of great things. So when you have those kinds of scenarios where it's like, I cannot find good examples of how people have designed well for this, this is a freeing process. You begin by just breaking down the types of content, discovering the chunks, uncovering the relationships. So let me go back to this really quickly. There are more content types that we uncovered with this site, but these are just the content types that relate directly to an episode. So when someone's viewing a page about an episode, they're not just viewing the episode itself. They're also pulling information about news items that were related to that episode, question and answer hours that were related, guest appearances, and then the guests that were part of those appearances and topics. There's a lot of sort of interrelationships. So as you do this kind of process, like, OmniGraffle is fantastic for this kind of thing. Just graffle something really quickly, begin to uncover where the relationships connect, help make sure that you in your head understand the relationship of the type of contents one to another. And this is a wireframe from the process that's going on right now. It's one of many iterations. You'll see here... Often it's best when you're designing for content management systems to go against your instinct to start from the home page. I think, like, the visual designer in me lots of times thinks of brand above everything, and when you're thinking of brand, your inclination is what's the home? How do people come into this thing? What's the feel? In this type of a process, especially from the structural part and even to the wireframing, figure out what the most important type of content on the website is, or sometimes it's what's the most complex type of content, and actually start your structural analysis and your wireframing with that and work out. You'll uncover things about that type of content in that process that'll actually inform how you think about the homepage and what bubbles up there. An iterative wireframing process helps this come out, usually. Let's see, it's a fast scroll, sorry. Okay. So here I have highlighted just the chunks of this content that are directly related to the episode content type. And in this wireframing, you know, we had this broad understanding of all the different chunks that are out there that all relate. These are just the ones that when you're creating the episode itself that would be there. You have a title, a publish date, a summary, a playlist link, an audio file link, and tags, like a way to taxonomize in a free tagging kind of a manner. Separately, you have a lot of content when you're displaying an episode that's actually not really part of the episode. It's other types of content that all relate. You have these topics. You have question and answer hours, guest appearances, news items, all these types of things. And you begin to see how important it is to sort of understand what's out there, know what chunks you can pull in. Let me scroll this. I don't know if it's actually working. So one of the things that I kind of skipped over to try to get the broad idea of the content types and their chunks out was hierarchy. And this is actually really, really important. By the time you get to the visual layer, by the time you're even at wireframing, you better already understand the hierarchy of this structure itself. So I encourage you to create three groups with everything. So when you're focusing on your content types themselves, create three groups and begin to put things in groups, a one, two, and a three. What belongs in the one? What are the most important content types on this site? What belongs in the two group and what belongs in the three group? Once you've done that, do the exact same thing with all of the fields or chunks that are a part of each content type. And you may need to think about that contextually because sometimes that level of importance actually shifts when you're teasing the content versus when you're actually experiencing the article. Make those lists, make those priority lists, and keep them handy as you're doing your wireframing. Evaluate against it then in the end, because the reality is you can have structured content that's very well thought out. Every type has its appropriate fields, and as people move through it, they feel like, whoa! You don't end up understanding it at all. Nothing wins. And so then that brings me into the next part of my talk, which is just simple fundamentals of design. By the time you've gotten to this phase, assuming that you understand all your content types, assuming you understand the context of your website, you understand the hierarchy of these things, you then have to begin translating it visually. And so I'm going to go through some Gestalt principles and a couple other fundamentals very quickly here. That can help you as you do that. These are very basic, very simple to understand. It's funny, though, a lot of times I did a whole talk series on just this that was like 45 minutes on visual hierarchy principles, and I kept having people come up to me and say, that was funny, like, because it was so simple, but I went to design school, and I don't remember really, like getting that in my head, and I've felt kind of the same way. So it's great things to just kind of remind yourself about all the time. Position, proportion, proximity, symmetry, similarity, alignment, contrast, color, isomorphism, unity, and pause. Okay. So, the psychology of visual hierarchy. How many of you are like, were psychology majors in high school? I don't know why I said that. So you might know way more about this than me. So here's what I know. There's this guy named Max Wertheimer. I know that there's other people that sort of contributed to this, but this guy named Max Wertheimer was on vacation in 1910. He's on a train ride, and his train stops in a town. And he decides, I'm going to get off and go shopping and try to find something interesting to bring back for my children. And he finds this thing called a stroboscope. If you've never seen a stroboscope, it is a spinning drum with slots in it, and these images spun in the drum with the slots. And it was like a very primitive form of a movie machine or a very advanced flip book. And it fascinated him, so much so that he ended up doing a whole bunch of research out of this, because what fascinated him was the fact that there were images that weren't there in the in-betweens that his brain was sure were there. And so Gestalt psychology is based on the observation that we often experience things that are not part of our simple sensations. A good example of this is when you look at this, some people might see Pac-Man at a family reunion, but most of us see a triangle that's not actually there just instantly. Especially visually, the whole is often more than the sum of its parts. Okay, so that's gestalt. Okay, now the principles. Position. Position is really simple. It's almost feels funny to be going over it, but the eye in the West naturally moves from top to bottom, left to right. Position is actually hugely important in language and communication. It's the whole way our language system works, actually, and things like this can be very difficult to understand, but then even without the correct proximity to separate words and everything, as soon as you get the position right, it's easily understandable. Proportion, if my clicker will work. Proportion, another very simple one. We tend to notice big things. Proportion, an interesting thing to note, is just that it has the power to override position. You can move something up in the hierarchy in spite of its position with proportion. A great example that I wanted to use of proportion is this SNL commercial from the 1990s. I couldn't find any legal way to actually get the thing on here without probably having NBC all over me for using or getting a letter from my ISP from using a torrent thing or something. So I'm not going to show the actual commercial, but in the commercial, Will Ferrell is Hank Petchow, who has developed Petchow brand rat poison. It's the only rat poison powerful enough to kill a large animal, even the size of his dog, Shep. And that's how you know it's good. It's great. And so his packaging, like he talks about how it's the good quality stuff because it has Pet Chow and it has his dog Shep on it. And down underneath it has the fact that it is indeed rat poison. It's a really funny commercial. So go to lb.cm/petchow and it'll take you right to it. Proximity. So proximity creates visual relationships. This is an interesting one that I see misused all the time on the web, where there's too much similarity, not enough discrepancy in proximal relationships, and you can't tell what some bit of text, some action item, or what something relates to. Does it relate to the thing above it or below it? Here we see that the text relates to each row of squares. You move it just slightly and it instantly relates to the other row of squares. You move the squares up and they all relate to one another and the text is divorced from it. Proximity, you'll see this is seen as two distinct groups because of proximity. You can enhance it with contrast or color, but the interesting thing is proximity is so powerful it overpowers other signals of distinction. That's why when you misuse it, it really creates confusion. It's very powerful in your tool set. Proximity is also really key in language and in understanding what's written. This is a problem in domain names. You have things like this. The importance of kerning and tracking is huge. Something that is experts exchange can easily be misread as experts exchange. You see the same thing in this store, and this is a record store in Berlin. It's really great. Interestingly enough, this is also an example of isomorphism, which we'll talk about in just a minute. Symmetry. Symmetry I love because I love the human brain. The human brain wants things to be whole so badly. Anything that's broken, it's like our brain just wants it whole. And here the law of symmetry is overpowering the law of proximity. It's much more likely that you saw that as three distinct pairs, even in spite of the proximity of the two inside ones. You can spread it out and make that proximal relationship even more severe in the middle, like that, and you still want to read it as three distinct pairs. Similarity, things that are similar are perceived to be more related than things that are dissimilar. That's like, sounds ridiculous. But it actually does affect like sort of where the eye goes. Similar things, like you probably kind of notice the squares first, the circles second kind of a thing. The eye is drawn to similarity. Alignment, like I talked about with my son Huxley and his cars, like alignment creates relationships. And it's also a way to create beauty, like grid systems, like help create beautiful designs, and it helps create that meaningful order. Alignment is also another very powerful one because you can provide other signals of distinction, and alignment just overpowers it. That relationship stays the same. And contrast, we've already sort of talked about a number of times. Contrast is a way of creating visual importance. You can have tremendous similarity and draw something out via a color contrast or something like that. It's a very basic principle. Color in and of itself, just one key thing to remember, and this is not so that you make color palettes that are one particular way. This is more of a way of approaching problem solving. When you have an element that you're trying to figure out how to bring it out, warm colors come at you or move forward. Cool colors always recede. And that's something, if you've ever taken a painting class, they'll teach you the way that you create push-pull is with warm to cool. It's a great thing to remember, because using a warm color can often draw something out that, you know, proportionally or something wouldn't be. Isomorphism, this is an interesting one. Isomorphism is similarity that can be behavioral or perceptual and can be a response based upon a user's previous experiences. When you look at this, you probably see a smiley face first, and then you see a plate with two eggs on it. How many are familiar with this internet meme from the early 2000s? Like, seen this before? It's interesting. It was actually a hoax, I think, from what I understand. Anyways, it wasn't actually a Cambridge research project, but it is interesting how the brain so badly wants to put things right. It wants to create story out of pattern, and so there it worked. I think this battery is dying a little bit. So isomorphism is about basically the brain's desire to see things in the patterns that has seen them in the past. Aaron Walter wrote a great book recently, Designing for Emotion. He talks about surprise. Surprise amplifies our emotional response. When we anticipate a moment, the emotional response is diluted across time. A moment of surprise compresses emotion into a split second, making our reaction more intense and creating a strong imprint on our memory. Surprise can be this wonderful thing in design because of this. It could also be horrible, because the reality is, if you surprise someone with something they don't expect and it's something that they don't like, it intensifies that, and all they can think of in your interface is that this thing that they didn't like that surprised them. This is an elevator in a hospital, actually. And this is an example of surprise, like, whoa! Patterns that you're used to. You have buttons off to the right that, like, you honestly, I don't know if I would be worried that I'm going to go sideways if I hit one. It's really bizarre. There are lots of patterns out there in the web. It's important to follow them, not just always blaze your own trails. So isomorphism is just this idea that responses are influenced by your previous experiences. Those create expectations about what should be where. So follow those well-worn paths. Unity is another simple concept. Elements and structures have a visual connection and look like they belong together. Right now, these look like they belong together just because of similarity. Unity would be something like this. You see this often in like patterns you'll see for like breadcrumbs on websites, where they'll create graphical connections between things to display the actual sort of directory structure, like chain of breadcrumbs. There's other ways that you can use Unity, but it's creating those graphical connections. Okay, pause. Pause, I'm not going to talk a whole lot about, but it's a wonderfully powerful thing. I don't even know who said it, but I love this. Pause is the awkward silence in our designs. When you have a lot going on, creating pause is a way to really draw something out. Instead of a lot, a little. Liz Dansico gave this fantastic talk, I don't know if it was last year's BuildConf or the year before, on the power of pause. Let her tell you more about pause. Go and watch this, lb.cm/pause. It's really a great talk. Almost done, wrapping up. If I can get this a few tips and tricks really quickly. So when evaluating visual hierarchy, this is something I use all the time, and I keep talking about it. So when you have two things, this works well with one thing, actually. When you blur your eyes or you stick something in Photoshop and blur it, you begin to understand where the visual weight lies. It might not be a highly discrete visual hierarchy, but at least gives you those ones and twos a lot of times. So if you're evaluating two wireframes, and if you've already done the work to say, we know what the chunks are, and we even know what's most important based on the goals we've set out for this type of content, you can then take those two wireframes and do this kind of a test and say, oh yeah, that one's doing what we said was our goal. This one's not doing it quite as much. I wonder why. And begin to tweak using the tools that we talked about with visual hierarchy. It's a really powerful tool. Like I said, it works well even with one thing. Like you can just, well, I had a college professor that in critiques, he would always ask you to like stand back and blur your eyes for this reason so that you could begin to see the things like the visual weight hops out. Another thing is when you're designing for content management systems, a lot of times you don't have a lot of control over what's going to end up in the content. Hopefully you have some control, and hopefully you can set some boundaries and some rules and have a good style guide. But I encourage you to, when you get to the front-end development phase, create a style guide page that contains every possible element that you're going to allow within your types of content, and begin to have that to look at and style against. It's also something that you can show people so that if something's not looking quite right, they can begin to understand how they should have marked it up. Like, I should have been using this type of headline because that actually looks nice, and the way I did it was really dumb. I just did a bunch of returns in bold. One of the keys also is to remember to include things like system messages, pagers, for pagination within things. Like go through all the form elements that are going to be exposed and include them on it and make sure that they're styled nicely. Drupal actually has a module for this. Like Drupal has that there's a module for that. It has a style guide module that actually kind of produces almost every type of markup that Drupal can produce on one page, unless you do this. I imagine there's probably similar types of tools for some other content management systems. And another thing that I've found very helpful lately, style tiles. Samantha Warren, I know, gave a talk yesterday, I think, and I've gotten to hear this talk one other time. And if you just Google style tiles, like her article is the top thing that comes up. This is a fantastic way to approach sussing out a visual language with your client or with the stakeholder in the project that doesn't necessarily, that it is able to divorce it even from content types even. It divorces it way out. So you're not in this situation where we're trying to produce a million mocks. We're trying to establish the same visual language and make sure that when you say, make that punchier, that I'm actually making that punchier, and I know what you mean. It's great. Okay, so I'm going to wrap up a little bit early and have some time for questions. Just in closing, I think it's just a huge thing that I go to every time, every week, I feel like at some point in my week, I say, okay, how do I have fun again? How do I make sure that I'm continuing to have fun? When you have fun, it just frees you to produce awesome things. And I know from just what I've experienced so far here at South by Southwest, you guys are awesome people, and you probably want to make really awesome things. Have fun with it. David Campbell, who's the founder of Saks Fifth Avenue, I said, discipline is just remembering what you want. I love that. Remember what you want, and a lot of these disciplines in design will just come along with it. Okay, so thanks a lot. If there's questions, I think we have a little bit of time, and there's a microphone that somebody has, and I'm happy to take them. Otherwise, you know, shoot me a message on Twitter or something. Yes, those were all Drupal sites.
What's the question?
He asked if the sites that I mentioned at the beginning that we had worked on at Lullabot, Grammys, MarthaStewart.com, WWE, MIT, if they were all Drupal sites. And the answer is yes, they are all Drupal sites. I guess he's picking out the...
Hi. We've encountered a problem in designing our site when we are incorporating both content from Drupal and other content management. We actually have three content management systems with database content. And in particular, when the database content is more dynamic in nature, is that something that you've dealt with as a design challenge, and how would you approach it?
Can you explain what you mean by when the database content is more dynamic?
Think the world's most complex and ridiculous Excel spreadsheet turned into a database, where you then want to be able to render that content in a way that's much more usable and understandable than if you were looking at it in Excel.
Yeah. I mean, that's kind of the crux of figuring out what the types are. That can be really tricky when you're working from like a database. I haven't actually encountered that personally in a design project where I've just had somebody hand me a big spreadsheet and say, start from this. That sounds really awful. I would say that developing some documentation that you can hand to your client to explain to them how to structure content and putting some of the onus on them to like say, work through this and begin to help us understand the types here. What are the types and where do some of these different fields in this spreadsheet fit in would probably be my answer, but it's hard to say. I don't have a lot of experience in handling large spreadsheets in design.
I thought it was really great that you went through Gestalt and that you brought up a lot of those principles and things like that, but I've always struggled with how you get Gestalt good principles into above-the-fold kind of dynamics, and then when you have to address something that's, you know, scrolling. Because that's one dynamic of all websites and stuff like that, typically, is that they scroll. So you might have a lot of these different principles, movement, motion, contrast, whatever it might be, but then, you know, you're also talking about an interface that's going to change dynamically as you're looking through the layout. And if you have any resources that we could look at that might, you know, help
right.
provide better understanding.
Meaning, like, it's not a static canvas, so as they scroll down the page, what's the at least the position things change, right? Yeah, that's a tricky one. The good news is that, like, as we went through those, position is one of the weakest of all those tool sets, and it's overpowered by so many of the others. So while there is sort of like this stigma about scrolling, like if what you're saying is like once you've scrolled down here, how do we then keep the hierarchy where we want it to be? There are design devices that are used in interfaces like persistent nav and things like this that are actually to address that kind of problem. I think you just really have to evaluate kind of what those things are. Is something important enough that it needs to follow me the whole way? So it goes back to a hierarchy question usually at that point. I mean, if you have... So, and that actually is sort of like... beyond what those principles naturally speak about, because we're talking about something like dynamically moving with you as you move about the page. So it's always changing in position, but it's always staying prominent. Yeah, I would say it's really a hierarchy question. You can't make everything move with you, so you have to pick and choose. I'm not sure if that really answered your question, but it's a good question.
Yeah, I work on learning management systems, LMSs, and one of the big problems I have is inherently most of the people that use it aren't compelled by the content. They're the people that have to take the training by their manager and so on and so forth. So my question is, how do you make non-compelling content relevant to the end user and make your site overall appealing to the people that use it, even when they don't want to be there?
That's wow. I would say that that is, you know, one case where the power of beauty might be able to help. There's a book called The Design of Ordinary Things. What's the name of the guy who wrote that? somebody here probably knows, and I can't remember his name. But he talks a lot about products that sort of their actual functionality isn't that interesting or compelling, but they're so beautiful that people seem to just want to use them. He talks about his first, he bought an Austin Mini, and he was sort of outlining different things that actually were sort of like not the greatest design, or the actual feature itself wasn't that compelling, but he kept wanting to drive the thing because of how beautiful it was. That's one thing that pops to mind, although, I mean, if you're talking about people in like some kind of a structured technical training course that just have to do this to complete their job requirements, I mean, I would say the key there is just to like figure out what are the ways that you can move people through this the fastest. Are there ways that you can encourage the content creators to begin breaking that content down into more discrete chunks so that we can summarize things more, like move people through as fast as possible? Because the reality is that their goal there for happiness is being done. I mean, so.
I actually am a UI developer for a content management system, and I'm wondering, what can we do to help our clients to design and develop their websites?
Helping them understand how to do it for your content management system? Which content management system is it?
It's called IMIS.
IMS?
IMIS, I-M-I-S.
Okay, IMIS. Okay. I'm not familiar with that one. So what can you do to help your clients know how to design for yours? Well, I would say, do you have good documentation?
No.
No? That's probably a starting point. Yeah, good, clean, simple documentation. And also, I mean, the whole isomorphism thing, like patterns, like, be open to making adjustments to your content management systems to follow patterns that they're used to, because there are a lot of sort of patterns that designers are used to designing for, and if your system deviates too far from that, you either need to heavily document it and then hope you have people who are interested in it enough for other features that they're willing to wade through that documentation, or you need to help it help them feel at home.
Let's imagine that you keep your content creators in mind, as you mentioned, and let's imagine that they're not very design proficient. And let's imagine that you put all the systems in place and define the content, as you've kind of described. Mm-hmm. What are the opportunities for kind of that wow factor and that sparkle factor if you've kind of got those two constraints?
Can you explain the question a little bit more? Like, what are the opportunities for the wow factor for that content creator?
I think for the end product itself, as opposed to kind of like providing these templates that just have like a lot of like boxes for images and kind of a very rigid grid structure.
Right. So just because you've developed a system that really makes it simple and has discrete fields for the entry of the content doesn't mean that the presentation needs to marry that, where it's like it looks like a form and it's just the output of the form. Really, I mean, that's the beauty of structured content, is like the formatting, the presentation of it is sort of wholly divorced at that point. I think we're about running out of time here, but one more minute.
Hi. You'd mentioned that a lot of designers create sites for the person that's going to come to the site for the first time. Mm-hmm. Are you guys using Drupal to kind of enhance that experience for people that you've known that have come back a second time to kind of give a richer, deeper experience?
Oh, I may have misspoke. I didn't necessarily mean what I was trying to communicate was that a lot of times as designers we focus on the people that are just hitting the site anonymously, like they're just visiting a website, as opposed to people that are coming and have an account on the site and are using it to generate their own content or do things like that. But that is an interesting thing. I'm sure that there are some other people here that do a lot with Drupal. Four Kitchens is here in Austin, and I see Todd there, and some of my Lullabot coworkers are here, and they may have actually some good anecdotes to about like ways that Drupal sites have sort of targeted users who are like targeted them differently. It almost sounds like kind of like Google advertising, the way that works, where it's like it's presenting something different to them after the first time and stuff. I'm not sure. I don't have really good examples for that.
We've just launched a new website. We actually asked people to tell us what vertical that they're in, and then we're trying to give them content based around that vertical. And then also, if they come back to the website, that we actually still keep that same conversation going. So that's kind
right.
of what we're trying.
Yeah, like with the radio show that I'm working on, they had interest in, there's the, this. It plays on stations all over the country. Some of the radio stations actually alter the time for it. Like they delay their airing of it and things like that. And they were interested in like just dynamically picking up where the person is and what the most likely station is based on where they were, so that they could actually alter the time listed whenever they're looking at the episode for that person. There are things like that that you can conceivably do. I don't know if that's a good example of what you're talking about. Yeah. All right. Well, thanks a lot, guys. I'll be around, so if you've got more questions, find me in a hallway.